Hey, how's it going, everybody? We're back with another edition of the Ad Podcast. And today I have a really exciting guest for you guys. Sandeep Dayal is the author of Branding Between the Ears, which is a marketer's guidebook for neuromarketing and really just thinking about the comparisons between how the brain works and how consumers actually respond to marketing. And I think it was one of the most engaging marketing books that I've read in recent times. I read a lot of them for this show. And it took a very complex topic, which is neuromarketing, which I've never made out of a meeting without wires attached to my head, and was able to really break it down and make it very applicable to your average marketer without getting too deep into the science and some of the more complicated pieces of it. So Sandeep is also the managing director for Serenti Marketing Group. And he's worked on massive pharmaceutical brands such as for AbbVie, Pfizer, Baxter, and a host of other Fortune 500 companies. So Sandeep, thanks so much for making it on the show.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
No problem. So hey, let's hop into your background to start. So I know you spent some time at McKinsey and in the consulting space. And I know that it was maybe during the first dot-com bust that you were starting to really dive into some of these ideas around what makes a brand sticky from the perspective of neuromarketing. So what was the issue that haunted you so much that you decided you had to write a book about it?
Yes. So I've been doing marketing for pretty much all of my professional life. You know, I've done strategy work, growth strategy work, marketing work, and what have you. And so, you know, if you rewind the clock all the way back to 2000, that seems like a long way back, but that is when the first internet revolution sort of came about, right? And people were super excited about it. They, you know, they thought that it would change the world and what have you. And what really happened for those that went through that boom and bust cycle was that for about 2 or 3 years, there was a lot of excitement in the air. People thought, you know, their lives were going to change overnight and instantaneously. So even companies who were, many of whom were my clients, felt like, you know, they wouldn't exist unless they did something about that. So this was all going on. And then as suddenly as it had started, you know, which was around the 2000s or so, and then around 2002, it started fading off. At McKinsey at that time, you know, almost 40% of the business was related to something, internet businesses. Mm-hmm. And then it just kind of, boom, it just went away. And I'd been very deep into it. And so for me, it was like, what the heck just happened here? You know, how can it be that on one day we think in a certain way and the next thing we have a big market crash and everything is gone? And all these companies were just wiped out.
Yeah.
Grocery companies, online banking, and so everything that we today, that we use so much, right, was just gone overnight at that time. Didn't happen online, you know, online groceries, online buying, you know, retail goods like pet supplies, or you take, you know, grocery, everything. It was just, everything was supposed to happen and then it didn't, but it's happened now. So, of course, I didn't know that at that time. But when it went away at that time, I was kind of looking at it and saying, hey, how does this make any sense that you have a situation where this offers so much benefit, which we now realize, like online banking offers so much benefit, but people are not doing it. You know, online grocery shopping makes so much sense, but people are not doing it. And it led to the realization, and this came off a lot of research. I actually went around and talked to a lot of people at that time to see, hey, what happened here? Why didn't you guys go on the internet and start doing all these things? And really, the single answer was that it's human behavior. The biggest barrier, which sort of marketers overlooked, everybody overlooked at that time, was human behavior. And human behavior, as we all know, doesn't change overnight. You know, it takes time. It can be something wonderful, but it just takes time for people to adjust, people to sink into it, to believe into it, and so on. And when you don't focus on those aspects, when you don't realize that it's behavior that you have to change, then you keep focusing on why your, you know, whatever your widget is so much better. And without focusing on the fact that, yes, your widget is better, but people need to find those accelerators, and the marketers need to find those accelerators for changing behavior. Otherwise, those things are not going to happen. And that was a big realization for me. and I got deep into behavioral science. So if you look at the book, it's deeply, the foundations of this book lie in consumer psychology, in behavioral science, and then understanding of neuroscience from the perspective that how does the human brain work? Mm-hmm. Right? If we can have a better understanding of that and start applying that to marketing, then we can do a lot better in helping people shape their choices. And mind you, branding is all about shaping choices. So that's kind of the background, maybe a long-winded answer to
question. Yeah, no. And I think, you know, you brought up an interesting component, which I know we'll dive into at some point, but just the idea of, you know, things now that seem so ubiquitous, and it's just getting users to take that first step. You know, I admittedly am a bit of a Luddite. You know, I'm a millennial. I'm on the older side of things, but I do tend to be a late adopter with technology.
Yeah.
And an example that you gave is like, you know, Uber. Like, I had been hearing about Uber forever, and it seemed like everybody was really excited about it, but I was just used to taking taxis, you know, because they show up at the airport and you jump in and they're already there.
Right.
I remember getting off a train in Atlanta after taking a trip from Washington, D.C. to Atlanta for a conference, and there were no taxis at that train station at 6:30 in the morning. I'm like, oh yeah, there's this thing called Uber. You know, I guess I'll give it a try. And you pop in your credit card, you hit the button, you're like, oh my gosh, this is the greatest thing that's ever been invented. Why didn't I, you know, try this before? And then you give an example where, you know, people will sit and wait for an Uber for 10 minutes when there's a taxi sitting right in front of them.
So,
yeah. So, or if you think about things now, like, I've sold two cars and purchased three cars over the internet now without even going to a car dealer. Yeah.
You're no Luddite then. those are things that not many people are doing. So yeah, that's amazing that you would do that with a car buying.
Yeah. Well, I think it's all about, you know, showing people the promise of the product experience. You know, when I think about what actually made the difference for us in the car side, my wife went to a Toyota dealership, and she got the typical male chauvinist car salesman treatment.
Right.
You know, the guy was like, you know, she was just looking for a Prius, you know, nothing crazy. Yeah. And the guy was like, oh, you know, is your husband around? You sure your husband shouldn't be here? Yeah. And she was so turned off that she's like, right. You know, I heard about this app called Carvana, and she gave it a shot. And then they showed up, they took our old Mercedes away. They gave her a brand new Subaru, which you outlined in the book about some things that Subaru did really well that we'll jump into later. The experience of not having to deal with a salesperson, sit on a car lot, have the car brought to you, it was just so frictionless. And now I can't get enough of it.
Yeah. And I think you highlight a very important point about it, which is, you know, the functional benefits of these things, they have been well known, right? I mean, if you just give it a little bit of time, you can say, okay, yeah, this is going to be easy and what have you. But it's those other things around human behavior, around making those connections with the consumer, whereby that consumer feels comfortable enough to buy a car from you. That's a whole different thing. And you highlighted a great example where, in a way, that, you know, that salesperson that you described, and it's so true for so many salespeople, particularly in selling cars, that they fail to pick up on that. They fail to pick up on making sure that they were firstly connecting with your wife, that there was an empathetic connection there, that there was some trust established there. Because until those things happen, a big purchase like that is not even going to happen. So I think that's kind of an interesting example of why it's important to think about those things. And now it becomes much more complex when you're a technology company and you're not actually going to have a human out there. Mm-hmm. So how do you be a technology company like a Carvana or an Uber and still do very human things like having people trust you?
Mm-hmm.
You know? So this was an aspect of marketing and branding that marketers just weren't thinking about. But now it's so critical to think about it. You know, one of the main things that I focus on in my book is behavioral science. And as you know, in behavioral science, there have been many Nobel Prizes that have been given. You know, Robert Shiller got one. Richard Taylor, University of Chicago, Goblin, and then Daniel Kahneman, who's kind of the father of this field, who recently died just, I think, 2 weeks back. He unfortunately passed away. But nonetheless, these were guys that changed many different fields, you know, from how you invest your money in the stock market, how people would go to, you know, public policy around, you know, what would make people donate their organs or opt to donate their organs or not opt to donate their organs, or public policy aspects, linguistic aspects, psychology aspects, you know, how to help people who are having mental issues change their behavior. You know, all of these different fields have been using consumer psychology and behavioral science now for the last 20, 30 years. They've really been perfecting it into a science. What was missing for me was people using that same aspect of an understanding of how the human brain works, how it makes choices, which is so fundamental to branding. It was kind of surprising to me that marketers hadn't focused on applying behavioral sciences over to branding. For the last 20 years, you know, we were talking about my journey, and the last 20 years in my company, Serenity Marketing Group, that is what we were doing. We perfected it. You know, we started from zero and then we perfected it into a science, which is what helped us apply those principles and you know, create some of the world's greatest brands. Like we work with Pediasure, we work with Humira on the healthcare side, we work with brands like Crystal Light and so on. So, you know, there's just a whole set of multi-billion dollar brands that we work with. I'm not taking any of the credit, by the way, on that. You know, there are real good marketers in those companies that did all of the great work behind it, but certainly we were involved, and certainly we were involved in advocating the use of behavioral science and showing how that could be applied to really make those lasting customer connections that I discuss in my book. So, you know, that is what this journey and this whole interesting field has been.
Yeah, I love it. So I wanted to tap on an idea. You mentioned that when marketers lean into emotion, specifically around the idea of trying to be really funny, or make them feel very emotional from the perspective of connecting to, you know, maybe sadness, or, you know, pulling on the heartstrings, as they like to say, which is basically every Super Bowl ad ever made, right? Yeah. Sometimes the concept of the ad will overshadow the brand, and people can remember the ad, but they can't remember the brand.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the potential pitfalls of leaning too heavily into emotion when you are designing a campaign?
Yeah, that's right. Let me just kind of back up a little bit. You know, if you go back into a little bit of history of branding, you know, historically, branding has been roughly about product differentiation, right? If you've got two products, you know, if I'm starting a company and I've got my product and you've got your product and we're both doing similar things, I just need to figure out how my product is different from your product and then go ahead and talk about those differences, hoping that consumers will care about those differences, right? That is product differentiation based marketing. And people confuse that with also brand differentiation. And for a while, those two things were the same. But as you know, in a hyper-competitive world, product differentiation only lasts so long, right? Whatever features I don't have today, I'm going to put them in there. Whatever features you don't have, you're going to put them in there. So, right, so those things tend to converge and you can't maintain that kind of differentiation. But brand differentiation is a special kind of relationship. It's a kind of a relationship that I often compare to the relationship that people have. You know, brands often personify their brands. They often think of brands as people. And therefore, those connections last much longer. So it's kind of understanding how those types of connections can be made. So what happened is that after product differentiation came emotional branding. So there was a guy by the name of Mark Gobi. He wrote a book, Emotional Branding. And then, you know, people said, oh, you know what, you shouldn't just talk about the functional differences in your products. But you should also put some emotion around it, happiness, sadness, whatever, anger, whatever, you know, you put some emotion in it and become stronger. And I think that is true to some degree. When you attach certain amount of emotionality to certain things, then it can be, it can be something that connects with people more, because we are humans and we have emotions. At the same time, what happened was that marketers started applying that very formulaically, you know, where they say, okay, you know, this is the difference. Now let's look around for a, you know, an emotion to add. And when they did that formulaically, it became unnatural. Mm. Because, you know, what we have as humans, and this is what we're learning through brain sciences, we don't have like, you know, here's my processor in my brain for functional differences. Here's the processor in my brain for emotional differences. What we really have are coherent thoughts, right? Which could be functional, emotional, or a combination of the two. We have ideas, we have thoughts in our minds. And when we go and, you know, for example, when your wife went to that salesperson, she felt disrespected. Now that's mm-hmm. a thought, you know, that's a thought that, hey, this person is disrespecting me or devaluing me because I'm a woman. That's a thought. It's not an emotion. Of course, there's an emotion associated with it, but it's a very specific kind of emotion. And it's a very specific thought and idea that was in our mind, which he failed to discern. And so what we are sort of now saying is that you really got to focus on these thought patterns. And what has happened is that as marketers have formulaically applied emotions to their brands, what happens is that either those emotions and those brands don't connect because they're just not relevant. On the other hand, what you can have happen is that the person watches a commercial and they're so focused on the emotional aspects of the commercial that they don't even remember what the brand was. And as mm-hmm. a marketer, you can't really afford to forget the brand. And one of the examples that I talk about is an ad that was done by Enbrel, which is a rheumatoid arthritis drug mm-hmm. By Amgen. And in their ad, they had this, actually it was kind of, you know, a nice little ad. They had this young girl who was a young daughter of a mother, and the mother had rheumatoid arthritis, and the daughter is talking in a very engaging way about how she thinks that her mother will no longer be able to do all the things that mother does for her.
Mm.
You feel so you identify with that little girl. She's so, you know, she's kind of cute and sort of very, you know, quintessentially how you would sort of expect a young kid to look. And so you have that connection, but in the connection that you have to that central character and to the things that you're talking about, you don't necessarily pay attention to the brand. And we have found that with many of these ads, that sometimes when you make them overly emotional, then people connect with the emotion and get distracted by the emotion, but they forget about the brand. Or you make them, you know, laugh out loud funny, and then people are, you know, remember the joke, but they don't remember the brand. So I think, and we're learning this through human, you know, brain sciences, and therefore it's an art to really understand how you're going to connect those pieces together, but balance it out so that in some ways, some form or fashion, your brand is what gets communicated to the person. And they know that they understand that your brand is kind of the key to unlocking those, you know, whatever those emotions or whatever those thoughts are that they feel. So that becomes a central idea in my book, which is that what the brands really have to try and do, which is when you think about what's in the human brain, right? So we go through life, we have a lot of experiences, and in those experiences are stored in our brain, right? What, you know, because you ask the question, well, what's in my brain? Well, it's your past, which is the learnings that you have from your past, and it has your fantasies. Those are the only two things in your brain, your learnings from the past, your past experience, and your future fantasies. And somehow the brand has to play a role by becoming the key that allows you or allows the brain to remember those past experiences in a part, the cherished past experiences, or it's the key to unlocking some fantasies that you have, that you feel like, hey, if I'm going to use this brand, is going to get me closer to my goals, and it's going to get me closer to what I've been fantasizing about, or it's going to be the key to opening up some of those cherished past experiences that I have, which this brand helps to unlock. So branding becomes more, much more interesting this way, and much more of a different framework than that simplistic product differentiation framework that we've used in the past.
Yeah, I love that. And one of the things that you hit on was this idea that advertising isn't really designed to make us have an experience. It's designed to make us recall upon past experiences that we already have stored in our brains.
Yeah.
Excuse me, I'm a sneeze there. But one that I was thinking of is Cadillac. For me, is a very powerful brand that I associate with my grandfather. You know, my grandfather drove Cadillacs, and he was an entrepreneur. And I always associate Cadillacs as the car that I wanted when I felt like I had made it. You know, when I could afford a luxury car, I would drive a Cadillac because that's what my grandfather drove.
Yeah. And I think that's a perfect example right there, Dylan, because then the car becomes so much more than just a car, right? Because it's for you, it's that brand is unlocking those fond memories that you have around about the time that you spent with your grandparents. Mm-hmm. So, and it's that kind of insight which if the marketers pick up, they will design better, ads and better brand positioning, because, that's so much bigger. That whole idea that I can recall with my product, I can unlock some of your most cherished experiences and moments with your grandfather. I mean, that's such a bigger idea than just saying that, hey, this is a nice luxury car with all kinds of electronics and features, right?
Yeah, totally. So I wanted to pose another idea. You know, I was having a conversation with a colleague the other day, and he had an interesting quote, which is, everything boils down to reproduction and consuming calories, essentially, when you think about, if you break down to like our most base instincts. And you talked about the example also that maybe brands of past celebration, like Victoria's Secret, who leaned heavily into sexuality and kind of having this aspirational models that were almost unachievable for 99% of the female consumers, but they did essentially create this aspirational nature. Do you think that's one of the reasons why these new female lingerie and or activewear brands who are kind of going along the lines in their advertising of using models that are more representative of their customer base versus this kind of unachievable status of a Victoria's Secret model? Is that also why those brands are succeeding, not just from the kind of maybe inclusivity angle, but because they relate more to the people that they see in the advertising?
Yes. And I think the short answer is yes. And in my book, I basically talk about how you can build brands. Fundamentally, it comes down to how you can build some brands without necessarily thinking about the product differences. And there are some 6 or 7 different types of brands that I outline, which are all brands that succeed without even talking about the product necessarily. And one of those ways of doing is in what I call brands with empathy. And so empathy is this idea of connecting with another human, right? It's kind of like, when two people get together and, get along really well, they have kind of this special social chemistry between them. And then what happens is if you feel that connection, if you can say, hey, that person really gets me, then you have this whole idea of whatever that person says, you're more likely to believe that, right? You're more easily and more likely to believe whatever it is that they're saying because you feel like they get you. And so brands that are brands with empathy are brands that sort of establish that special social chemistry with consumers and making them feel like, hey, this is a brand that really gets me. And then therefore, when they make the next statement, which is why, hey, you should use this brand and so forth, people are most likely to use that brand because they believe it. They believe they have that connection. And I think Victoria's Secret is a very interesting case, because initially it wasn't just the fact that they were showing sexy women, but that what they were doing was they were celebrating the fact that it was okay for women to be sexy. Right? So you can, you know, sometimes they were wearing things that nobody might see or what have you, or only their boyfriend might see or what have you. But, you know, it just sort of put them in a situation where they could celebrate their own bodies. And they felt like there was a brand that understood that this was something something to be celebrated, and not underwear that you put behind the stores and, you know, in a box that nobody sees, and then you have to tell the store manager to bring it out or something, which is how it used to be, by the way. That underwear was actually back of the store stuff. But, you know, they created full stores and they brought it out, you know, everywhere in stores, on runways and everything. So, you know, women really felt like this was a brand that understood the fact that they, you know, they had a natural sexiness and they could celebrate it. Where they went wrong, and they succeeded, by the way, you know, if you look at their stock curve, it looks like a bell curve. You know, it went up like a rocket and then it came down like a rocket.
Yeah.
And that where they went wrong was in betraying that trust that they established with those women. And, you know, you can't do that when people, you know, you can make a mistake once, or, you know, once, maybe twice, but you can't make a mistake many times in a row. And what Victoria's Secret did was, through various incidents that they had, they kind of sent a message that said, oh no, you know, our brand is only suited for, you know, women that look in a particular way, you know, but if you're a woman that's like regular women, then, you know, you're not really welcome on our runways. You know, they used to do a runway show and so on. So it was like, then people said, huh, you know, you're saying this brand is only for that small set of women, but not for me. So it actually made people feel bad about their bodies versus what it did in the past, which is to celebrate whatever bodies women had as sexy. So I think, and then they made, you know, I'm not going to go through in all of the details, but they did several other things which sort of sent that message that they had betrayed that trust.
Yeah.
And that is when women just moved away from that brand, and the stock went all the way back down to where it started, and the brand nearly went out of business. Let's see where they come out now, but they're trying other things. But other brands noticed, and they did exactly what you talked about. They came out with, you know, everyday women and celebrated their bodies and so forth, and created brands with empathy and took away their market share.
Yeah, no, that's a interesting case study, because like you said, originally they were leaning into maybe the feminism movement in a lot of ways, if you think about it.
Yes.
And they kind of maybe got a little above their skis and then kind of missed out on the inclusivity component. And then imagine trying to create a certain brand perception. If you alienate a big base of your customers, then, you know, it doesn't matter if you're aspirational, if nobody agrees to aspire to that anymore, I suppose.
That's right. That's right. And I should mention as an aside that, you know, with most brands, you're going to make a mistake sometime or the other. You know, we recently had the Budweiser case where, you know, you saw all that people smashing up their Budweiser cans. And this but it is important when those brands make those mistakes that they recover from those mistakes quickly and authentically. And you know, when they don't, then they get into trouble. And at some point or the other, most brands have gotten into some level of trouble. But so having a playbook for figuring out how you get out of that hole is also very important. And Victoria's Secret just didn't have a playbook. They just didn't see it.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, you brought up another interesting example, which you had a few case studies as well, which was kind of leaning into this activism component that we see prevalent in brand storytelling these days. Some brands do it very authentically and have meteoric rises because of it. And then others do it in ways that have been very detrimental to their bottom line. You gave a couple of, I think, three great examples, which was Ben and Jerry's ice cream, which is a great ice cream, you know, disguised as an activism brand, very driven around their founders, you know, political leanings and what are important to them and their lives. But now Unilever, it became a Unilever brand, and then Unilever just sold off all their ice cream again.
Yeah.
So another example that you gave was Nike in standing with Colin Kaepernick during his political activism. And then you also gave the example of Subaru very in kind of a, you know, a much earlier time frame during the Clinton administration, kind of standing in solidarity with a core audience that had kind of emerged around their brand, which is the lesbian community. So then there are examples like you brought up in more recent times, like Budweiser, where maybe they didn't understand who their audience is, or, you know, maybe frat guys that drink Budweiser don't want to be lectured about politics by their beer. But then it's totally acceptable for a company like Nike because it actually bleeds into their brand ethos, and they end up selling more shoes to their core consumer that stands united with them and their messaging, versus maybe like a Target just missed their earnings for the first quarter in a very long time because of a similar political blowback from being, you know, associated with politics. So can you talk about, you know, when is it right for brands to lean into politics or activism, and when can it be detrimental?
Yes. So I think in my book, I talk about two different kinds of brands in the particular examples that you've used. One is brands with empathy, which we just talked about, and brands with values. And these are two very different animals, if you will. So brands, and both can work, by the way. Second one is a much harder place to be in. But brands with empathy, as I mentioned, are brands which sort of make an empathetic connection with you, a social chemistry with you, and that is why you trust them. Brands with values are brands that say to you as the consumer that I share in the values that you have. And values basically means what is your sense of what is right or wrong, you know, morally right or wrong. That's a very different thing than just feeling connected to a person, which is a brand with empathy. And there are certain brands, and Ben & Jerry's is a very quintessential example of a brand like that, which really focuses on all kinds of controversial issues. In fact, brands with values, by definition, will focus on a controversial issue, because there's no controversy, then it's not a question of value. You know what I mean? Like, your values are really tested when the going is rough.
Yeah.
Right? It's like you can say, hey, my value is to speak the truth always. Yeah, but, you know, you can speak the truth, say, hey, the sky is blue today. Yeah, of course, you know, you said a true thing, but it was not very hard to do that. Mm-hmm. But it can be very hard. Many times speaking the truth can be very hard, and that is when your value is truly tested, that do you actually always tell the truth, right? So brands with values take particular stances, and then and if you decide to be a brand with value, if you as a marketer, as a brand, decide to be a brand with value, you have to stick to it. Because if you give up on it when the going gets rough, then nobody is going to ever believe that you're an authentic brand, and you will lose that connection with the consumer. So Ben & Jerry's has been very clear that they are an activist brand. You know, whether it's prison reform, whether it's voter rights, and, you know, whatever it is, they're very clear that that's the brand that they are. And there's a certain set of people that are very loyal to Ben & Jerry's as a result. Not everybody, but a certain set of people are very loyal to that brand because of that reason. And therefore, Ben & Jerry's can never afford, you know, it's a high pedestal to be in when you're a brand with value. And you can never afford to then not be true. You know, just because things get rough, then you say, okay, you know, wait a minute, you know, the president is speaking against me and what have you. He's gonna target my brand. So yeah, I better stop talking about this. So you can't do that. Once you choose to be a brand with value, you have to stay there. Nike was a very interesting example. And, you know, we had that situation with Nike, which is when Colin Kaepernick took the knee in the field, everybody went after him. Like, you know, the whole world went after him. The president of the United States went after him and what have you. And he lost a lot.
Yeah.
But it was this idea. When you're Nike, the brand, let's think about what Nike, the brand, has been about. Nike, the brand, has been about helping people in sports achieve their dreams against all odds, right? It's a performance brand. You know, it says, and that's why they've always been sponsoring so many athletes, because many of these athletes that they talk about succeeded when nobody believed in them.
Yeah.
You know, they kept at it and they believe, and that's the message, that's what that brand is about. And when, you know, Colin Kaepernick, when he took the knee, he was doing something that he believed in. And therefore, for the brand not to stand by him at that time would have been to actually go against the DNA of what Nike is. Why they put up those ads in Times Square and on billboards and so on, which is something like believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything, which is kind of what Kaepernick did. And that is what a lot of athletes actually do. You know, they drop out of school, they go against their families and what have you in pursuit of their dreams. And Nike is the brand that tells them that no matter what, we will stand by you. And so that's a very critical thing that, you know, you as a marketer, you have to decide what your brand is going to be about. But once you make that choice about what you're going to be, you can't waver. And I think Nike was a great example of a brand that didn't waver.
Yeah, I like that. So it wouldn't be a modern podcast without addressing AI. So you mentioned in the book AI, that you're actually bullish on the human element of marketing and that you don't think AI is going to replace humans. Mainly because AI can't think like the human brain, and it takes actual marketers to have those in. Like, AI is an incredible tool for certain tasks, but at the end of the day, to create messaging that is going to resonate with a core consumer because of how the brain works, you need humans to design that marketing. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, just your perspective on how AI is factoring into some of the things that you're thinking about?
Yeah. So, I mean, when I wrote the book and I was writing about AI, I was looking at it more in the context of, you know, self-driving cars and so forth, and which is what was happening more than things like ChatGPT, which has happened now. So I would have to say that my own thinking on AI has actually been evolving, and that I do think that in the future, AI is going to be able to do many more things than I thought possible at that time. So, you know, I'm actually happy to admit that I'd be willing to be corrected on that, and I'm second guessing myself at this point, I would say. So let me take a step back and talk about AI for a second. So artificial intelligence, again, it goes back to that fundamental question: how does the human brain work? And can I then use computers to make the computer work the same way as the human brain does, right? I mean, that's fundamentally what we're trying to do. We're trying to replicate the human brain. Now, what happens is, and this is what Daniel Kahneman, the psychologist that I was mentioning earlier, who recently passed away, great guy, great person who changed the whole field of psychology and economics, but anyways, what he said was, and this would be familiar to many of your listeners, what he said is that the brain actually essentially makes choices in two different ways. One is it makes choices instinctively, you know, kind of like gut feel. Okay. And the second is that it makes choices by deliberating on certain things. You know, you do a spreadsheet, you do the logic tree or whatever, you know, those kinds of things. So instinctive and deliberation. He called these two things system one and system two. Okay, but essentially, simplifying it down, it's instinctive, the gut feel decision making, and more reasoning based or deliberative decision making. Now, let's talk about AI. So those are the two ways in which we think. If AI could do both of those well, then it's getting closer to the human intelligence factor, right? Is kind of the issue. Now, what has happened is that in the past, the computers have always done deliberative thinking or reasoning-based thinking very well, and better than humans. And that's why you see them winning chess competitions and so forth. Because ultimately, you can program all those things in. The computer can do math faster, it can do logic trees faster, and all of those types of things. And therefore, computers are already ahead of humans in things like deliberative thinking and calculations and logic trees and all of those types of thinking. So system two, they're already better at. So question is system one, where we make instinctive decisions. Mm. And what we are finding is that instinctive thinking is essentially associative thinking, which is where we have certain learning, that holds. Remember what I was talking about earlier, that our brain is full of our past experiences, which have been turned into learnings. And those learnings are based on just observing things, right? It's not, for example, a very simple example would be, even the caveman understood that, even though it was dark at a particular moment, in 12 hours, it was going to be light again, or in 8 hours, it was going to be light again. So they understood day and night. So they could, just by observing that every day and night happened, they knew how day and night was going to happen. They didn't necessarily understand the planetary movement. So they didn't know how it happens. They just knew it happens, right? So there is a lot of learning that we do instinctively just by observing associations and correlations, because things happen together and what have you. And now what is happening is that when you look at ChatGPT and generative AI, what it is doing is it is putting learnings in place by observing these correlations, observing these associations. So when you keep feeding it more and more data, it's looking at things that you and I don't even possibly look at, because we can't handle that level of data. And it's looking at, oh, these two things go together and these two things go together. And that's how it actually generates the words. But long story short, I'm now beginning to believe that computers are going to be able to do system one, instinctive thinking, also better than humans as a result of these associations. And that'll create a very interesting world in the future where humanity itself, and I think in some ways, is going to be challenged.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember I interviewed Rashad, who wrote one of your forewords about this in 2017, and he was already predicting a lot of these things. He was way ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, I appreciate your update to that quote. We'll definitely think on that. So I wanted to dive into kind of my area of the marketing space and wonder, what the field of influencer marketing has on this whole idea of cognitive branding. Do you, as a marketer, pay any special attention to the power of celebrity endorsements or influencers on social media, and how that kind of hierarchy of association and brand reputation by kind of, people who you idolize or look up to, like, how does that have an impact on how you have an association with a brand?
Yeah, and I think it's a very interesting and new area of branding that, and certainly I think about it a lot. And there are a few things going on there, because for one, marketers really have to pay attention to the influencer marketing piece, because in the past, it felt like you could control consumers and control, what is going on in your market a lot more, because, you would be controlling the advertising, you would be controlling the television channels, you would be controlling what was appearing in the print ads and so on, billboards, shopping shelves and all that stuff. And so you felt like you controlled marketing a lot more. But now what happens is, because of influencer marketing, there's marketing that happens in which you're not involved as a marketer, right? And that is where the influencers and viral marketing and, you know, peer-to-peer communication, that is taking place at a scale that is much grander than it was ever in the past. Now, mind you, it was always there in the past. People always talked about the clothes they were wearing or something they bought or the car they were driving. They talked about that with their friends, but it was in a very limited way. Mm-hmm. Now what is happening is because of the networking where you can be reaching out to thousands and sometimes even in certain cases, millions of people very quickly, that whole impact of peer-to-peer marketing that happens outside of the marketer's control has just mushroomed, has just exploded. So yes, influencer marketing has become a key piece of what people in my shoes need to really think about. So that's definitely there. And I think it draws its power from that very fact that people perceive those conversations that they have with influencers because they have some kind of an empathetic connection with those influencers, right? So then tend to believe everything that influencer says. It just goes back to that whole idea that brands behave like people. Yeah. And when you feel like there's a person that you connect with, that, you know, here's a person that gets me and so on, you tend to believe, you know, the 80 other things that they say. And the influencers have, it's not easy being an influencer, by the way, and it's not everybody that can be a great influencer. So, you know, I congratulate you on that and on what you achieved, but it is that ability to make that, be on a screen, be on technology, be not there in front of that consumer, but yet be there and, you know, somehow have that feeling that this person understands. So I think when that happens, that connection is so solid and so compelling that it is something that is an essential part of what brands have to work with today and embrace, you know. And I think in certainly with men I'm working with my clients, we certainly encourage them to embrace influencer marketing because it's so important these days.
Yeah, I think you kind of hit on a couple of interesting ideas. One is that because we spend so much time online and on social media platforms, and these platforms are originally intended for us to have connections with friends. And, you know, your social network can be loosely defined as friends, right? Like there are some people in my social network, like my wife and friends that I still spend time with. You know, those are real friends and real relationships, but then there's maybe 90% of the rest of the people in my social network might have been somebody that I knew in high school or knew in college, but I haven't talked to them for 10 years, but we're still friends. But because of that connection of social media and the intention of it being a network effect of friends, I feel the same way sometimes about my friends as I do as an influencer, because I kind of experience them in that same format of them sharing, you know, intimate details of their personal lives, unlike ways that celebrities ever did before when they were just on ad campaigns or in TV shows and in movies. We kind of get to see them on what they look like in the real world. So we have more of this, you know, authentic connection to them. And when they try to influence us in the idea of brands and what brands we should be paying attention to and supporting, then, you know, we feel very strongly about those recommendations. I also think an interesting component is the idea of the influencer-led brands. You know, so many startups now are basically like Shark Tank, the reality show on social media. You know, you're not just following along with the brand, you're following along with the founder and them going through the trials and tribulations of starting a company, you know, doing formulation. I mean, basically it's a never-ending feed of Shark Tank style content, which is an extremely popular show and genre. I mean, the whole CNBC network is basically the Shark Tank network now. And so now people feel like they have a relationship with brands in a new way because they feel like they have that same relationship with the founder that they do with other influencers.
Yes, yes. And I think you touched on a lot of different things which are important in behavioral psychology. For example, when people are going into a journey together, you know, if you feel like you're part of the journey, just like in Chartered Bank you're describing, you're likely to believe in that journey a much, much more. It's kind of if you've, you know, if you've got a hand in baking a particular pie, you're going to prefer that pie over other pies that just appear out of nowhere, right? That's just a psychological effect. It's called the IKEA effect, but you know, IKEA people build their own furniture and they like that furniture more than other furniture, even if that furniture is inferior. So that's an observed psychological effect. And then the idea, there's another very important idea that Kahneman talks about, which is familiarity, which is when you see something more often, then or experience something over and over and over again, it becomes familiar to you. And your brain has a tendency to prefer things that are familiar to it. There's a positive to it, there's a negative to it. Positive, I mean, for marketers, the simplest way to do it is by advertising a lot, that you see the brand everywhere and feels familiar, and then you start preferring it one day subconsciously without even realizing that's happening, but it comes through repetition. The negative side of it is that people can promote falsehoods by repeating the falsehoods often, and then they start feeling like something that is true. So that's a bad side of it. But nonetheless, I think with influencers, because that interaction is pretty regular, you know, people see something or the other, there is, you know, the influencers make sure that there is some content or something interesting that is coming relatively frequently. And that frequency does also have a huge impact in establishing familiarity, and that familiarity breeds trust as well as preference. Mm-hmm. So I think, and like I said earlier, branding is all about creating preference for your product. So we like to look at those things very carefully. And therefore the psychological aspects that were embedded in what you just said are actually very important things that we focus on.
I love it. All right. Well, we're getting down to the home stretch here. What are you most excited about the work that you're doing in the future around cognitive branding? What are you excited about for the next year or so?
Well, I'm just excited about this field because it's just growing and it's becoming a bigger and bigger part one way or the other of many more brands. And I think we're seeing that people are engaging, as you said, you know, directly or through influencer marketing, as you talked about. So that's called marketing with us and without us, which is the without us piece is the influencer marketing. So that's becoming a very important piece. There's also this whole aspect of thinking experientially about the brands in terms of engaging all the senses. So, you know, look, thinking very deliberately about, okay, the person has a sense of listening, a sense of sound, a sense of smell, and so on. And how do we think specifically about each of those elements? Because one of the other things that we know is that the more comprehensive the experience you make, you know, so there's sound associated with it, there is, you know, lights associated with it, there's all. So if you engage many more senses, the more powerful and immersive that experience is going to be. And when we say it's a more immersive experience, it means that it is getting embedded in your brain more deeply and you're going to recall it more easily. If you recall it more easily, you're going to prefer those types of things. So I think that is there. And then I think this whole artificial intelligence, as you were talking about, and how that is going to be augmenting our sense of reality is going to become very important in as far as brands are concerned. You know, we know there was all this hullabaloo about metaverse, and then again it kind of went away. By the way, for the same reasons, I still think that metaverse is going to be a big thing, but people were expecting it to be a big thing overnight.
Yeah, too early.
Yeah, you're kind of forgetting human behavior. You're forgetting that the technology is not there. But over time, you know, if you look over 10 years from now, technology will have advanced a lot. When you look through those goggles, you're going to see a world that is way more, it's going to feel like no different than the world that you see without those. Mm-hmm. And it can be a fantasy world, and can be, and the technology will be cheaper. You might be able to get those glasses for, you know, $20 versus $2,000, you know. So once all those things change, the metaverse itself is also going to become a much bigger thing than VN, because it engages right at the senses. It's a very immersive experience. It writes, encodes things right into your brain. So I think, I mean, that's one part of it, but there's going to be those types of things, but also embedded technology in terms of, you know, the human technology connection. Mm. And, you know, Elon Musk, who does all kinds of crazy things, but he has a company that's called Neuralink, which is now working on, you know, letting people control things by thoughts. But so, which is sort of, he's embedding things into their brain, so to speak. And, you know, once that technology also advances, people will be using embedded technology in their bodies and their brains and so on in very different ways than what we can even visualize now beyond watching Star Wars movies. But I think many of those things are going to become real, and it will change our world in a way that that we probably can't imagine right now, but it will change our world. And you know, as a marketer, you know, that drives a certain amount of fear, and people say, hey, fear can be good for you. So, so no harm in that, you know. And but I think regardless, over the next 20 years, it's going to be a much more interesting world for marketers.
Yeah, well, it's going to be a brave new world. I'm excited to be a part of it. Well, Sandeep, thanks so much for this conversation. For those of you at home, definitely pick up the book again, Branding Between the Ears. It's, there we go, screenshot that. It was an absolutely fascinating read, great applicable things that you can use in your marketing plans and your strategies today. So definitely recommend it. Sandeep, anything else you want to plug or point people towards?
Yeah, no, I'm always open to hearing from people. So I have a website called sandeepdayal.com, and I put out my blogs there with new ideas and new things like the change of heart I've had about AI. Mm-hmm. But also, yeah, people can, you know, find other ways to connect with me, including on LinkedIn and so forth. So thank you for having me on your show.
Yeah, definitely. Well, for those of you who are listening at home, wherever you're listening or watching this podcast, mm-hmm. don't forget to subscribe so you get to see extra episodes in the future. And if you would be so kind as to leave us a review, that helps the show find a larger audience organically. And most importantly, if you have a colleague out there who you believe would benefit from the conversation that I had with Sandeep today, don't forget to share the show. So Sandeep, thanks again for coming on.
Thank you very much. This was fun.
All right. Have a nice evening.
All right. Thank you very much.